Thanks for having me, Larry. My recent book is called The Twilight Struggle, What the Cold War Teaches Us About Great Power Rivalry. When we think about the U.S. competition with China or with Russia today, these are not the same things as the U.S.-Soviet Cold War. Xi's China is not Stalin's Soviet Union or even Mao's China. Putin's Russia is not Stalin's Soviet Union either. Now we worry about a beleaguered international order that's coming under strain. Back in the late 1940s, there was no international order, and that was part of the problem. The geography is different. The levels of economic interconnectedness are different. When I talk about lessons of the Cold War, I'm not arguing that everything is the same and we can just simply rerun the Cold War playbook in vastly dissimilar circumstances today. We can still learn a lot by looking back on the Cold War for a couple of reasons. The first reason is that the Cold War itself wasn't that exceptional. It was just one manifestation of a much longer-running competition between great powers to shape the international system. We have instances of this going back to the ancient world. We can see it in the early modern era. We can see it in the 20th century. The U.S.-China and U.S.-Russia relationships today are just part of this larger phenomenon as well. There's really one time in our history that we've geared up for extended decades-long competition with an authoritarian great power, and that is the Cold War. The United States, in order to succeed in the Cold War, had to rally big, unwieldy coalitions of allies. It had to blend competition with negotiation and cooperation. Current events are making the history of the Cold War look more relevant. We've had a period of heightened tensions in U.S.-China relations over the past 18 months. It's become increasingly common to refer to the U.S.-China relationship as a new Cold War. There's a non-trivial danger of hot war and flashpoints like the Taiwan Strait. And so the sort of skills and competencies that were necessary to get through the old Cold War with the Soviet Union successfully are unfortunately going to be necessary with China today. We're seeing the same thing when we look at U.S. relations with Russia. Russia remains the more aggressive of the two great power rivals that the United States confronts, and it's a country that we ignore at our peril. Autocratic great powers are still quite willing to use force to get their way in international affairs. Those conflicts present real risks of spillover and escalation, and so the crisis in Ukraine has intensified, protracted competition for influence with Putin's Russia in Eastern Europe and potentially beyond. We've had the luxury of 30 years of post-Cold War peace. That period's over now. We're heading into a period of much higher dangers, much higher tensions, and we really do need to learn from the past if we're going to navigate the future and its challenges successfully.
Hal, how do you compare the beginning of the Cold War with today?
One of the really striking parallels is that during the early Cold War, the United States is often pushed along faster by its allies. NATO itself was a European initiative. Creating a transatlantic alliance was about the last thing that Harry Truman had in mind. We only did it because that was the only way of reassuring the Europeans. We often find ourselves surprised by how fast our own allies want to go in periods of crisis. And we've certainly seen this in the Ukraine crisis. I mean, we've experienced about 10 years of history in 10 days or so. We've seen pledges to dramatically increase German defense spending, much more assertive foreign policies from countries in the European Union. Crises catalyze big departures in American foreign policy. The threat that a communist insurgency posed to Greece and that Soviet pressure posed to Turkey led Harry Truman to go before Congress in March 1947 and give his famous Two Ways of Life speech, where he sort of outlined the ideological rationale for the Cold War. It was the Korean War that led to the approval of NSC 68 and much higher defense spending, along with a global network of alliances. America's approach to competitions evolve in fits and starts, and those are often prompted by unexpected crises like the ones we have today.
What do you think of John Mearsheimer's argument that it was a mistake to push our NATO alliance to Russia's borders because it scared Putin and forced his hand?
His argument was NATO expansion antagonized the Russians and have caused them to lash out violently in Georgia and Ukraine. I don't find that argument particularly persuasive. Russia has long sought to create a sphere of influence in its near abroad. It didn't need NATO expansion to want to exert that influence as it started to recover from the extreme weakness of the 1990s.
Yale professor John Lewis Gaddis wrote the definitive history of Cold War strategy in his book Strategies of Containment. Gaddis describes two different methods to undermine Soviet aggression, the symmetric and the asymmetric approach. Symmetric implies that if the Russians attack the Ukraine, then we defend it. The asymmetric approach would be to challenge the Russians in a different way, economic sanctions, attack Russia somewhere else. How could the U.S. use asymmetry against Russia in the Ukraine?
I think asymmetric response is almost always desirable in principle. The idea of playing to your strengths, choosing areas of the competition where you can really thrive, not simply reacting to your opponent's every thrust, that's really compelling. It has a strong logic, as John points out in that book, which is the Bible of strategic studies from a historian's perspective. There were a number of U.S. initiatives during the Cold War that employed that asymmetric logic to very good effect, right? The Marshall Plan was a great example of asymmetric containment. We're going to use money, technology, expertise to revive the economies of Western Europe in a way that the Soviets cannot hope to match in Eastern Europe. The military strategies that the Reagan administration pursued in the 1980s is an example of asymmetric strategies. Make investments in missile defense or really accurate precision-guided munitions that the Soviets can't match. I don't know whether the economic sanctions are going to work in terms of pushing Russia out of Ukraine. That's a big ask. But they have certainly shown that the United States and its allies can do an incredible amount of damage to a relatively significant economy in a short amount of time. I mean, this is the most comprehensive sanctions package ever put in place on a great power. Russia has been almost totally disconnected from the world in the past 10 days, and the speed and severity of it has just been striking. And I think it's a testament to the strength of U.S. economic and financial power, especially when you combine us with our allies. And I'm sure the Chinese are taking note of this right now. The problem, though, with asymmetric strategies is that they require leaving things undefended. If an asymmetric strategy doesn't succeed in getting the Russians out of Ukraine, then you still got to deal with that problem. During the Cold War, asymmetric strategies didn't deal with the North Korean invasion of South Korea, which is why we ended up in sort of a symmetrical response thing there. And so it's one thing to draw up these strategies kind of in the laboratory and another thing to implement them in the real world.
Will there be a peace deal in the Ukraine?
I don't think that Putin is going to go to the Ukrainians with a set of demands that they can accept. The minimal Russian demands at this point still involve the destruction of Ukrainian sovereignty, the recognition of Russian sovereignty over Crimea and then the Donbass, probably pretty severe constraints on Ukraine's political autonomy and its foreign policy. I don't see the Ukrainians accepting that sort of settlement right now, because they would leave themselves vulnerable to what Putin had in mind the first time, which was the utter destruction of the Ukrainian state and probably the murder of most of their political elites. Putin has put himself in a position where he's really motivated his enemies in Ukraine. They're not going to give up. They're actually doing fairly well militarily. I mean, shockingly well compared to what most expectations were at the outset. I'm actually not entirely sure whose side time is on at this point. Maybe the Russians will get it together with their operations. Maybe they will start fighting in an even worse way where they're just leveling major Ukrainian cities and ramping up the pain to where Zelensky feels that he has to yield. But the Russians are already absorbing pretty high casualties. That's going to take a toll. They're starting to lose significant amounts of equipment. They have 100% of their force that they mobilized committed in Ukraine. You can only keep that going for so long before people and equipment starts becoming combat ineffective, and the sanctions are going to bite harder with time. And so if you asked me who's going to be in a better position 2 months from now, it's not entirely clear to me that Russia will be.
Should the Ukraine consider hitting the Russians on their home turf to escalate the fight in an asymmetric way?
I don't think it helps the Ukrainians militarily. Their problems are in Ukraine, not in Russia. And it hurts them politically, where they've been incredibly shrewd so far at garnering the sympathies of the democratic world, at positioning themselves as sort of the plucky underdog against the Russian Goliath. And if they start taking shots at major cities, that could change relatively quickly. I don't know that Ukraine has the offensive capabilities, and I think the Ukrainians are going to be hard-pressed just to defend the major cities, prevent their forces from being encircled in key places. There is a political dynamic here, though, which is that the longer and the costlier the war gets for Russia, the more Putin has to worry about his own political standing at home, if not with the Russian people, then with the group of intelligence and military and economic elites whose support he relies on to remain in power. And one exit scenario from this war is that somebody in Moscow gets tired of Putin's costly war if it drags on and looks unsuccessful and takes matters into their own hands.
John Mearsheimer has stated that the real enemy is a great power that can challenge America's international order. And today, that is China and not Russia. So we should try to get Russia on our side to balance the Chinese.
I think it's hard to argue right now at a time when Russia has unleashed the largest intrastate war in Europe since World War II that Russia doesn't present a significant threat to the existing international order. There are times when you really don't have an alternative but to take on multiple enemies at once. During the early Cold War, the United States sought to contain Communist China and the Soviet Union simultaneously. We should look for opportunities to play on differences between the Russians and the Chinese. If the Russians ever have a change of heart about their alignment, we should certainly welcome greater cooperation with them. But that's a pretty distant prospect at this point. And so I think we just kind of have to reconcile ourselves to the fact that we face two big threats to the international order that we've created, and we've got to deal with them both.
Since the end of the Cold War, the U.S. has combined hard military power with soft economic or cultural power. And the Europeans have encouraged diplomacy and soft power and objected to the use of hard power to solve disagreements, probably because Europe lacks hard power. And now, with the invasion of the Ukraine, soft power seems useless. Has this realization been the driving force for the European desire for moving toward acquiring hard power?
Well, Putin accomplished in a few days what the United States had failed to accomplish in about 10 years, which was to get Germany to take defense seriously. Ukraine is a really big country that has frontage on a bunch of Eastern European states. It's not that far from Germany. And so Putin's invasion has really driven home to European leaders in a very visceral way that they still live in a dangerous neighborhood. And there's no way of making the military math add up if Germany's going to spend 1.4% of GDP on defense. If Putin had rolled through the Ukrainian defenses like a lot of people had expected and had effective control over the most of the country right now, Europe's security situation would be a lot worse, because combined with the effective Russian occupation of Belarus, you would have a much enhanced Russian ability to apply pressure against NATO states from the Baltic all the way down to the Black Sea. And that really would be an epic security crisis for Europe that we haven't seen in decades. And so the Ukrainians have really done a lot of good work for the Europeans by bogging the Russians down to a certain extent. But there is a parallel in the sense that the degree of security that countries thought they had turned out to be illusory. And so now they start to realize they've got to invest in their own defenses, even as they also invest in the alliance with the United States.
Why didn't Putin find a diplomatic solution instead of attacking the Ukraine?
The Biden administration tried to give Putin a decent off-ramp if he wanted one. The offer was, if you're really worried about NATO military deployments in Eastern Europe, we're willing to talk about that, and we're willing to address concerns about long-range strike systems. What became clear pretty quickly was that Putin wasn't really interested in that stuff. Putin was interested in the destruction of Ukraine as an independent state, and we shouldn't be surprised because he's been telling us that for a number of years. Putin wanted war in this crisis, or he wanted a complete Ukrainian capitulation, which he probably only could have gotten through war. And I think his behavior throughout this crisis simply reveals that.
It seems that the Russian military was caught off guard by this sudden invasion, as if they expected Putin to be only blustering.
As amazing as it sounds, I think the answer to that is yes. I think there was a very small circle of people around Putin who understood this was real, and most of the Russian military, perhaps even much of the high command, thought it was diplomatic posturing. And I think that helps explain why a lot of the operations have been so shambolic.
Okay, let's say that the Russian military was taken by surprise by their supreme leader and now realize that they're in for the long haul in the Ukraine. Can they regroup to win the battle?
That's a really interesting question. Militaries do typically learn in wartime. We're only, 12 days into this conflict. They don't appear to be learning very fast, though, and that's a puzzle for me. And I can't tell whether that indicates that their heart isn't in it or there's some other pathology that's preventing them from getting smart fast.
In the Cold War, the U.S. and the Soviet Union did not fight directly, but instead used proxies and provided arms to their respective proxies. Is that what we will see in the Ukraine?
I think you're seeing a similar pattern today already. Putin attacks countries that are not U.S. allies. He doesn't attack countries that are U.S. allies. The U.S. provides arms, it provides intelligence, provides other forms of support to the Ukrainians. It doesn't send its own troops into combat. I mean, so far, there seems to be at least a semi-tacit agreement on the rules of the game, on what each side can do without eliciting a military response. The question is, will it break down if Putin gets more desperate as the conflict goes on?
Do you think that the Russians will attack the NATO supply lines to the Ukraine?
Right now, he doesn't have the forces to cut down through Western Ukraine and basically sever the land bridge between NATO countries and Ukraine. They might wish to do that. And if you get into a situation where there's a Ukrainian insurgency or something like that that's being supplied from the West, the Russians would certainly try to apply various forms of pressure to do that. During the 1980s, the Soviets occasionally went across the border from Afghanistan into Pakistan to try to clean out some of the sanctuaries that the anti-Soviet guerrillas had created there. And so I think that is a very dangerous situation. You're going to get sort of a contest in coercion between the two sides.
If the Ukrainian masses are engaged in street-to-street fighting, do you think that Putin will get frustrated and turn to massive civilian attacks?
Well, he's already killing lots of civilians, unfortunately. There have been bombardments of civilian areas in major cities, targeting of civilians fleeing the fighting. It could get a lot worse, obviously, in the way that you allude to. Vastly higher numbers of civilian casualties would provoke a really anguished debate in the United States and other societies about whether we should be doing more to defeat Russia in Ukraine. Any use of force in Ukraine obviously brings nuclear dynamics into play, and so that is certainly not something that should be taken lightly. And I don't have a huge amount of sympathy for proposals for a no-flight zone and things like that right now, but if this thing gets as ugly as you're hypothesizing, then it would raise some questions about whether deeper Western involvement in the war is warranted.
What happens next with the military engagement in the Ukraine?
Well, the Russians have some major decisions to make in the next couple of weeks. Are they going to commit more forces to the fighting if they're not able to achieve their objectives? Are they going to level the major cities as a way of coercing capitulation? Because what they're doing right now, I don't think is working to secure the political ends that they want to secure. Putin is not going to give up. I don't think the Ukrainians want to give up either right now. And so that's why I would not be surprised if we end up in a conflict that drags on. But that said, I'm driving in the dark as well as anybody. My initial expectation is that the Russians would have done much better militarily up to now than they have. And so I certainly wouldn't claim to have a crystal ball on this.
What do you make of the private firm's decision to leave Russia?
This was relatively unexpected. I don't think many people predicted that you were going to see Russia isolated from the international economy and from international society as thoroughly over such a short period. And this is provoking some degree of introspection, if not Putin, then among people around him, that they may have miscalculated the cost of this whole thing. Private sector sanctions are not new. They played an important role in the end of apartheid. In South Africa, for instance, when major banks stopped rolling over South African debt in the late 1980s, the Chinese have sanctioned entities that do business with Lithuania, because Lithuania opened a Taiwan representative's office in Vilnius.
Has the Ukraine situation changed the Chinese calculus for invading Taiwan?
I think there are a bunch of interesting lessons. The Chinese need to double down on indigenous technological development. They've probably also been shocked by the ferocity of the international response. This episode has shown the importance of talking in advance about what economic and technological sanctions you might put in place if China were to jump Taiwan. It probably indicates that you want to strengthen your forward position in the Western Pacific. It's just a big reminder that major war is not passé.
I end each session on a note of optimism. Hal, what are you optimistic about?
Putin has reminded us of the fragility of the international order that served us very well, and it's already eliciting extraordinary efforts to shore up that international order against countries that are trying to destabilize it. I'm actually a little bit optimistic that the West could end up in a stronger place if it uses this crisis as an opportunity to invest in a way that allows us to defend an international order that's come under strain.